This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you have a question for Zorba? Well, then give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. Along with your calls, always some interesting research. What do we have this time, Zora?
Finger length. Male finger length that doesn't predict financial success.
What do you mean, finger length?
Well, we'll talk about that. That's why we're talking about the study.
Okay.
And cutting calories may boost your ability to answer questions.
Cutting calories, losing weight might make me smarter?
Eat less. Get smart.
Speaking of eating less, what's our recipe?
Banana berry muffins. It's dynamite. It's great. It uses soy milk. You will love it, Tom. You'll love it.
And heart healthy, too.
And of course, Tom. Always. Always. Only the best.
We have our medical myth buster coming up later in the hour. Lots of good reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Let's get to the phones. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Conover, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, my question is, I am of Scandinavian descent and have been under the impression for probably since I was in junior high that if I do not baby my body by, like, going outside when it's cold without hat, mittens, or a jacket, that it makes me tougher and more immune to colds and things like that. And I'm just wondering if that's true. Or if that's just kind of my warped sense of Scandinavian pride.
Well, let me ask, from your experience, does it seem to be true?
Well, I think I'm healthier.
I think this is a great theory. What do you think,
sir? Well, it's a great theory if you're from Scandinavia. That's exactly it. People in the South would say, you're nuts. What do you mean you're going outside at 20 degrees below zero without any clothes on? It's interesting. Lots of these myths, which is sort of what they are in certain ways, abound. And there are myths such as, you know, opening up a window, close the window, you'll get pneumonia. You know, if you are in something that's too wet, if you have wet clothing on, you've got to get outside, change it, because you'll get pneumonia and you'll die. And these are things that developed over time that sort of don't really correspond to why people get colds and why they don't. Now, on the other hand, we don't fully understand why some people get colds and some do not. For many, many years, and I have a very busy medical practice, I'd go for a year or two and not get a cold. And then one year I got a flu shot because I had gotten influenza the year before. And ever since I got that flu shot, I've been getting two or three colds a winter. It's that dang flu shot that produced all those colds. And in fact, my immune system just alters and changes.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the bottom line. You get colds from other people. The viruses are transmitted from one person to another. So, for instance, if you worked in daycare and you had lots of little kids around you, you would get more colds. You don't really get tougher from going outside. On the other hand, you do get acclimated to your weather. And the fact is, some people complain and complain and complain. And those people, not only do they get colds, but they complain when they have a cold. Whereas you go, oh, I have a cold, and just sort of get rid of it. So.
Now, here we have a three-person study going on, Zorba. We have three people from Wisconsin. Two of these people bundle up in the cold.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And one of them toughs it out and doesn't bundle up.
Right.
The two people in our study who bundle up and are
right,
really careful
colds,
are
right,
sitting
yeah,
here with colds right now. The one who doesn't have a cold.
Well, that's right. Two out of three. That's right. You won.
There you go. My theory is proven.
You won. Your theory is proven.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. I'm fascinated, Zorba. What's this study about finger length?
Finger length. You know,
yeah.
There are a lot of myths in our culture concerning finger length and men. And one interesting question is whether or not it leads to more aggressive, risk-taking behavior. And in the financial world of trading, that might turn out to be money. And so this was an article published in a reputable journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Proxy, as it's called, is really a major, major journal. And they looked at ring finger length compared to index finger length.
Index finger, okay.
In other words, if the ring finger was bigger than the index finger, longer than the index finger, and that ratio.
Yeah.
Did it have any did it in any way mirror financial success or trading? And lo and behold, it did. The guys with the longer ring fingers compared to their index fingers scored better on the financial success, earned up to 5 to 10 times more in terms of trading on London Stock Exchange and London Commodities Exchange versus the guy with the short ring fingers.
How many people did they look at?
They looked at 50 people. 50 people.
50 people?
But wait a second. Wait a second. Ring finger, it turns out that the development of the ring finger occurs, as well as other things, in the when you're the fetus in the womb. And if you have more testosterone, if the woman has more testosterone and androgen in her body at that time, it turns out that's what we think produces a longer ring finger. And we know that testosterone may be associated with increased confidence, risk-taking, aggression, heightened vigilance, quickened reaction times, all those things that you need for trading. And over a 20-month people, those with longer ring fingers, get this, made 11 times more money than those with short ring fingers. Now, what do you think about that, Tom?
Well, how do you...
Well, I looked at my ring finger, my index finger. They're the same size, so I don't know if that's good or bad.
I mean,
so maybe it's neither good nor bad.
Well, you probably shouldn't,
how about
shouldn't
you?
Be on Wall Street.
I shouldn't be trading. How about you?
Is your ring finger shorter? My ring finger
is shorter.
No, it's the same size. It's longer. I missed my opportunity.
You missed your opportunity.
I could be a gazillionaire.
That's right. I'm Wall
or
Street.
Or in jail.
Or in jail. That's right. Or bankrupt. You're the guy. You're the man, Tom.
So wait a minute. Ring finger and
index finger. I mean, both of those, and what do you have? This is public radio, Tom. We don't discuss
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. To Oklahoma City, Oklahoma we go. Hi.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I called about a year ago. My wife and I, she had gotten
pregnant. Oh, I'm sorry. We have a one call per decade limit. So, no, we don't. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, she had gotten pregnant after a long time of trying, and this beautiful pregnancy, she was troubled with the severe case of morning sickness, and you guys helped me out of that by advising me to just carry around a trunk full of candy. So every time she had a craving for something, I could just run out and get it and be the hero. And it worked out pretty good, so
great.
Thank you.
Great.
Well, now my son is suffering from, the doctor's calling it eczema, and we got an appointment with the dermatologist to kind of nail it down. But in the meantime, it's taken a long time to get in to see him. He is just suffering from this itchiness. I mean, he sometimes can't sleep, and we have to put gloves on his hands because he'll scratch until he bleeds. And
ooh.
And besides Benadryl, which I've been advised to use, I want to stay away from giving him drugs. The one or two times that we have given him Benadryl or something like that, it just really knocked him out.
Poor boy, he's only a year old, right?
He's almost 6 months old.
Oh, almost 6 months.
So what does your family doctor, pediatrician, say about this?
She says it's eczema. She prescribed a steroid cream, which seems to help, but then the Benadryl for the itching, and then the like Eucerin type lotions and things like that. My question or my idea was: can food, diet? I mean, is there anything that we could look at to see if it's in our diet or? I mean, I just wanted to get your opinion on
it. Oh, sure. Of course. Well, first of all, looking at the right things to do, Eucerin is the name brand of a very, very good sort of a cream ointment-y type of a thing that you can put on, and it's nice. It protects the skin. It makes it feel better. It keeps the moisture in the skin. Steroid creams, of course, really help in using the right creams in the right way is very important with eczema. And then not bathing your child too often, making sure that the water is lukewarm. It's not too hot, which is usually not a problem with babies. And then covering his hands at night are also very important so he doesn't itch too much. And the Benadryl at bedtime in a small dose, I would try a few drops and see if that would help him sleep. Benadryl is great. It's not addictive. It's not habit forming. It really works. I would highly recommend using it because he's uncomfortable at nighttime and it's a safe drug to use with kids. But just find the smallest amount. And if it knocks him out at night and he sleeps and he doesn't itch, that's okay. That's what you want. Now, as for food? Well, that's been a big question for many, many years. There's some people who say, yes, I have eczema, and when I eat certain foods, it really bothers me. And other people, food doesn't seem to have much of a, you know, doesn't seem to really affect it in any way. But with your child, you can't really eliminate many foods. I mean, he's drinking mom's milk or...
Yeah, she's breastfeeding, and we've not giving him anything else. He's just on breast milk right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's nothing you can eliminate. I mean, he has breast milk, so there's nothing you can really do. The food thing is very iffy. It's usually not the problem. It's really a local skin problem. Getting a dermatologist, talking about other medications such as Protopic, P-R-O-T-O-P-I-C. Protopic is one of the drugs, one of the creams that are used for eczema, and just using it the right way. Often they do adjust to it and get better over a period of time as their skin sort of thickens. So.
All right.
Good luck. Use the Benadryl at bedtime. If he sleeps well, I highly recommend using it. It doesn't cure anything, but it sure helps.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 800-462-7413. On to St. Louis, Missouri we go now. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. How can we help?
Well, I've been a chronic snorer for about 3 years now. And I'm married, and I went to a ear, nose, and throat specialist, and he said that I would need 3 surgeries to really solve the snoring problem. He suggested a nose surgery, which I think he said was adenoids, getting my adenoids removed.
Mm-hmm.
Also, getting my uvula cut off, tonsils removed. He said each of those, when I had them done, would help a little, but it wouldn't really be fixed until I did all of them.
Wouldn't it be easier for your wife to get earplugs?
Yeah, my wife has been using earplugs and a fan and whatever other white noise she can in the meantime. And so I actually ended up having the nose surgery, the adenoids removed.
Yeah.
And it didn't help at all. I mean, I didn't notice a thing afterward. I've had a stuffy nose since as long as I can remember, and nothing changed then. And so... the earplugs have been hurting my wife's ears, so I've been sleeping on the couch. And I was just wondering if, Zorba, if you thought that it would be worth it to go through with the other 2 surgeries, or if there were other alternatives I could try.
I've got a couple suggestions. First of all, these surgeries are very iffy. There's no surgical procedure that has been shown to work with all snorers at all. It really hasn't. And so you could remove your uvula, which is sort of part of the soft palate in the back. When you open up your mouth and a little thing wiggles around, you can remove that wiggly thing and you may still snore. And that's a much more extensive surgery. You know, straightening out the Mohs or just removing the adenoids, I think that's a very reasonable thing to do. But if it didn't affect the snoring at all, I doubt if it's going to affect the others. Now, I want to talk a little bit first about the doc. This is a doctor. How'd you find this ENT doctor?
I kind of just looked him up. I looked up some doctors online, and I found some reviews, and people seem to like him, so.
Uh-huh. Okay. So what I would do is I'd get a second opinion on the surgery. I would go to a university environment, and that's where I'd get a second opinion, or a major medical center. And the reason is I have never sent anyone – I have a lot of people who snore. The whole state of Wisconsin is really loud at night because they all seem to snore because obesity is associated with snoring. And let me tell you, we've got a lot of people who are overweight in our state.
Not as many as Mississippi.
Not as many as Mississippi. But in Mississippi, it's warmer, so they don't have as many blankets, and blankets can make you snore because you're in your bed. But getting back to the issue at hand, which is not obesity. So we rarely, almost never send people because the surgery doesn't really work well. Now, there are some other things that tend to work that are new things that have been developed, and these are mouth guards or sleeping guards that you sleep where you put something in your mouth and it keeps your mouth, you sleep it. It's sort of a dental retainer, and you can find them online for about $30 or $40. And for some people, those retainers open up their mouth just so much that they don't snore. And that has gotten some recent reviews, which have been very useful, as well as just like the nose strips that you put on that are made by Vicks and other people that sort of open up the nostril a little bit. And I'm not sure exactly why they work, but I know that that's what I would try next.
Okay.
And I would try a mouth guard. And I would definitely get a second opinion. I would not have. The uvular surgery is really extensive surgery. It's not like the adenoids. You don't have the same recovery. And I question whether or not 3 procedures at 3 different sittings, I question a doc who's kind of doing that.
Thank you very much.
Does that help?
Definitely. I'd heard something else about a dental appliance, but they were saying that would be like $500.
Well, there are. There are dental appliances that are $500, and there are the cheapy knockoffs that cost about $30 or $40. And we'll put a connection with that on our website. So if you come to our website, zorbapastor.org, I'm not going to recommend it. I'm not making money off of it. It's not the Zorba Pastor sleep at night, no snoring dental appliance. Although, frankly, if it works, you know, it might be my next career.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, keep people
I'll
from snoring.
I'll try anything at this point. So.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 800-462-7413. Before our recipe, Zorba, let's take this letter from George in Rayford, Florida, who's an inmate at the correctional institution there. He writes, "Often when you speak of antacids or calcium supplements, you mention chalk as in blackboard chalk. But blackboard chalk is no more chalk than a lead pencil is lead. True chalk is calcium carbonate used last when kids wrote on slates. Your show is very popular here," that's there in the institution, "and I know that some people at Florida's Scenic Union Correctional Institute eat blackboard chalk as a calcium supplement because Zorba says so. Having a spare moment, I decided to drop you a line to let you know what's going on and hope that you'll tell listeners not to eat blackboard chalk."
I will tell them. You know, I have to look up and see what's actually in blackboard chalk. But it sounds like this is a very knowledgeable chalk person.
It certainly does.
Yes, the word has gone out. Do not eat blackboard chalk.
We'll chalk this one, I guess, up to a misunderstanding. Keep those letters coming or send your thoughts in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. And thanks for listening, guys. I appreciate it.
Stick around for the recipe. Lots more of your calls. Some more really, really interesting research, and of course our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. With Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, and we do have an open line. Callers are waiting, but a line is open for you at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, before our next call, though, it's recipe time now, and this one for banana berry muffins, which smell good, I can tell you, and we'll find out soon if they taste
luscious.
Good. Yes.
They're a delicious smell. So, you know, what we want to do when we look at muffins is how do we take a muffin and make it healthier? Muffins sort of have a healthy panache more than donuts, but in fact, a lot of the muffins you
muffins
get...
Muffins really aren't very healthy.
They're not very healthy. Yeah. And in fact, if you look at a muffin and a donut, they're pretty similar. Often, most muffins and most donuts are very similar in what they give you. Now, the donut may be higher in oil, but it's really a function of how big they are.
Yeah.
You can get a small donut and you have a big muffin and you may have twice as many calories and twice as much fat in your big muffin as you do in your small donut. Yeah,
but not so, in these muffins.
No, these muffins are very good. So it's banana berries. So let's talk about the recipe as we go through. 3/4 cup of all-purpose flour.
Okay, 3/4 cup of all-purpose flour.
So pick the flour you want to. I use unbleached white flour when I use a recipe such as this. I just like the texture of it. Mm-hmm. You want to find a flour that you like that you can use. You can use a regular gold medal or Pillsbury flour, but 3/4 cup. 3/4 cup of whole wheat flour.
3/4 cup of whole wheat flour.
Now, you don't often find whole wheat in a muffin recipe because we associate whole wheat, rightfully so, with bread because it's a really more robust texture. But it turns out very well in this muffin. Now, if you used all whole wheat flour, it wouldn't rise. Uh-huh. So whole wheat is just too heavy for it. But half and half really works well. Good. Half a cup of sugar. You can substitute half a cup of honey for that if you want to, and honey will give it a different flavor because honey is different than sugar. 1/4 cup of oatmeal.
Quarter cup oatmeal.
So what we're doing is we're adding fiber, we're adding whole grain goodness to it. Very important. You can use oat bran if you want to. Oatmeal, we always have around our house because especially in the wintertime, we tend to eat a lot of oatmeal. Yeah. So we've got it sitting around there. 2 teaspoons of baking powder.
2 little tea baking powder.
1/2 teaspoon of salt.
1/2 tea salt.
2 bananas, which are mashed up.
2 mashed up bananas.
That's right. 1/2 cup of soy milk, unflavored soy milk.
Oh, 1/2 cup of unflavored soy milk.
Now, you could use regular milk if you want to, but soy milk in this particular recipe we use because a lot of people are going to soy milk. You want it to be unflavored. Frankly, if you used it with a flavored soy milk, it just adds a few more calories because when they add flavoring, they often add a sweetness to it. You could put buttermilk in this, and it will be very tasty. I've not tasted it with buttermilk.
But it wouldn't be as heart healthy.
Well, buttermilk may be a little bit less heart healthy. You're only using 1/2 cup, and if you look at the fact you're making 12 muffins, it's not going to mean much. Oh. So you could use that. 1 egg.
An egg.
Egg is good. I wouldn't recommend using egg beaters. You could use egg beaters, but frankly, there's nothing wrong with a few eggs a week.
Okay.
2 tablespoonfuls of vegetable oil.
2 big tea vegetable oil.
I use canola oil all the time. That is the oil of choice in our house. Mm-hmm. Corn oil would be okay, but you're much better with canola oil. 1 teaspoon of fresh lemon juice.
1 little tea fresh lemon juice.
So now I know, Tom, you get fresh lemons every week and put them in your house for your baking needs, right?
Every time I need to bake anything, I always use fresh.
It's like, but if you don't have fresh lemon juice, as Tom doesn't have it in his house, get the frozen variety, which is next to the orange juice in the freezer case. It's much better than reconstituted lemon that you buy in the container. 1 teaspoon of vanilla.
Little tea vanilla.
And if you have it, 1 1/2 cups of fresh blueberries.
1 1/2 fresh blueberries.
Right. You can do it without the blueberries, but blueberries are great.
Oh, and no. It's banana, berry.
That's right.
Muffins.
And blueberries are the expensive part. So here it is. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Now, line 12 muffin cups with paper liners. Combine all the dry ingredients in a bowl and whisk them to blend. Then place the bananas in a separate large bowl. Stir in the milk, egg, oil, lemon juice, and vanilla. Then fold in the dry ingredients into the wet ingredients. And then, when you're all done, add the blueberries and mix. You want to add them at the end because otherwise they'll smush up, which is what you don't want. Divide the batter evenly among the muffin cups. Bake for 20 minutes or until a toothpick comes out clean. Cool for 10 minutes and serve. Delicious. Each muffin is 158 calories. That's about 1/2 the number of calories that you get in a traditional muffin that you buy in a store. They're usually about 350 to 400 calories. Mm. And you get to eat one. Mm. And I get to eat one too. This is delicious.
That's
absolutely delicious.
Now, is this heavier because of it tastes a little heavier and more chewy than a lot of muffins. Why is that?
Because it's healthier. You see, you're used to white fluffy stuff. And the fact is it's a little bit heavier, meaning that it has a little bit of the texture of the oats, of the whole wheat. The fact is you're getting much more fiber than you normally do. Mm-hmm. When you look at it, we definitely get more fiber in there. There's protein, not much protein in here at all, but calories are only 158 calories. And from a fiber point of view, you've got about 2 grams of fiber. That's more than you'll get in a muffin.
Mm-hmm.
So one muffin is 10% of the fiber you need for a day. That's a lot.
Now, if you'd like to make a bunch of these, just go to the web at
ZorbaPastor.org. You can find this recipe there, search the archives for past recipes, and sign up for our weekly podcast. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Neenah, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey, guys. I have a question for you, and it's actually about my husband.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Lately, after everything he eats, we have found out that he has this kind of phlegm problem where he has to clear his throat a couple times after everything he eats. And I know it's not my cooking because it happens when we're out to eat, too.
you said lately. How long has it been since he didn't have this problem?
I would say we've kind of noticed it more in the last 4 or 5 months or so, but we haven't changed anything with our dieting, you know, with our eating or anything like that that we can pinpoint it to.
How long have you been together?
We've been together for 10 years.
Oh, in just the last few months this has been going on.
Yes.
Well, you know he's not allergic to your cooking. That's a big issue because, you know, you wonder, well, am I putting something in the food? Are some foods worse than others? Is it worse in the morning or the afternoon or the evening? Tell me.
I guess if, you know, I never thought about the time, but possibly more so in the evening, but it's not really necessarily one food over another kind of food.
Not one food. How much coffee does he drink, by the way?
A pot a day.
So this is a heavy coffee drinker. A pot.
Yes.
How big is the pot, by the way? Big pot a day?
It's usually about a 10-cup.
It's about a 10-cup pot of coffee a day.
And it's not always in the morning. It's kind of throughout the day, but
it's
throughout the day.
Okay.
Probably about that much throughout the day.
So I think this is probably an acid-related issue. Acid can often produce these situations where the extra phlegm where you go, you know, you're kind of clearing your throat, is often due to acid that occurs afterwards. And a very, very useful treatment is to go and just for about 3 or 4 weeks, get over-the-counter Prilosec, P-R-I-L-O. O-S-E-C. Get the generic. It's just as good as the name brand.
Okay.
And what he ought to do is take 40 milligrams, 2 capsules. It'll only say 1 daily. I would take 2. Take it in the morning when he gets up. See what happens. At the end of a month, if he's better, then you know what it is. You know it's acid. Then reduce it to 1 a day and see how that is. Things that make this type of acid reflux worse happen to be coffee. Mm. Now, he may not be able to give up his coffee habit, but he might be able to curtail his coffee habits so that he doesn't have 10 cups of coffee a day. Maybe he has 5 cups of coffee.
They've been together for a bunch of years, and he, I assume, has been drinking a pot of coffee every day for
a bunch of years. Right.
And now all of a sudden, why does this pop up all
We call this the aging body. We call this the aging body. You know, when you're first married, your body's young and supple, and, you know, you can pretty much do anything and stay up late at night. And after 5 or 10 years, your body just doesn't work as well. You're smiling, Tom, because you've had many years of an aging body.
No, I'm an old person. I don't have any aging body.
Right.
My body is just as young and supple as it always was.
Tom is on heavy antipsychotics. So you do not have to believe anything that he says. But what happens is acid gets like that. And what happens is as we get older, when we're younger, we have a very tight esophageal sphincter. And this is the bottom of the esophagus, the beginning of the stomach, and it keeps the acid down there. And as we get older, what happens is that sphincter tends to loosen up a bit. And things that will make it looser are alcohol and caffeine. Those are just things that tend to make it looser. And it may be by the end of the evening he's had more coffee. But try the Prilosec, see if that works, and let us know.
I have one question for you, though.
Sure.
If we go down to the one pill a day, then is this something that he would have to be on kind of on a regular basis
What some people find is they go through periods of this where they're really bothered by it, and then they take the Prilosec, and then other periods where they're not. Some people have to take it every day. So some people take the Prilosec every day, and they're not bothered. And some people, once they get it under control, maybe because it's a little inflamed, and they stop taking it, it gets better. And then some people take it because they know they're going to have acid reflux with certain meals. Hot Mexican food, for instance, would do it. Going out to a party and know you're going to have 3 or 4 drinks at a party or 2 drinks at a party will do it. Or you're drinking a lot of coffee. So it's mix or match. But you want to see if you can get rid of it because that's the way we make the diagnosis.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys so much.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Zorba, a listener joins in now from College Station, Texas. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling in regards to something that I ask almost every physician that I visit. It's kind of a little detail that I've just become accustomed to. My toes and fingers seem to always be cold. I don't know why. I've asked around, and I guess the term for it that I've come in, like, heard is cold-natured. I'm cold-natured, but it's just become an annoyance, and I think I've just become just so used to it. I don't want to be used to it anymore, and I'd like to know how I could be more warm or if I have some type of deficiency or if I need to take a certain vitamin or what it could be.
Wow.
You know?
Well, now, are you a cold person otherwise, emotionally, I mean? Are you cold?
No.
You sure? Because they could go hand in hand. No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Zorba, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because a number of people have cold extremities, and it is a circulation problem, but it's not a circulation problem. There's something called Raynaud's phenomena, and Raynaud's phenomena in the extreme is where you have spasm of the little arteries, the tiny little arteries that are in the finger, and the fingers can actually turn white, they can be blue, they can be painful, they can be uncomfortable, and it has to do with, if you will, a sort of an overactive circulatory system at the tips of our fingers and our nose and our toes. And so some people, when we go outside in the wintertime in Wisconsin, the blood shunts away from our extremities because it's too cold out there and moves to the center of our body. For some people, it's an extreme, such as yourself, and they have cold hands, cold feet. Sometimes you can see the whiteness on them when it occurs, and sometimes you can't. And it's called Raynaud's, Raynaud's. It can be drug-induced, too.
Any danger in this?
There's no danger. It's just kind of unpleasant. And there are some treatments. There are some drugs that actually you can take. Most people do not take them because they don't want to take a drug every day for it. It doesn't usually bother them. They're a type of high blood pressure pill that works in essentially relaxing the little arteries at the end of the fingers, and they can work. But for most people, say, well, you've got to put on gloves in the wintertime, and you've got to sleep with your socks on, and that's kind of how you handle it. But what age did you first discover this? When did you first notice it?
Well, I think in middle school I brought it up to my mom, and she's like, well, just put your hands under your thighs when you're sitting, and, you know, just things like that. And she'd buy me thicker socks, but nothing, you know. I think it was around middle school, and I started noticing that I was just cold.
Right, and the answer is basically to treat it locally by wearing gloves. But it's hard because if you're cold when you're inside, you know, you wear gloves. People go, well, why are you wearing gloves? You know, why don't you take off your gloves? I mean, it looks kind of goofy. Socks people don't care about because they don't see it. Is it more of a problem with your finger or your feet?
I would say my feet.
Okay. So the foot answer is to wear, you know, you want to wear shoes that are insulated when you're going outside in the winter, and double socks can make a huge difference. A thin layer on the inside and then a fluffy layer on the outside can make a large difference. I would highly recommend that you look and see whether or not you can double sock, because sometimes that can make a big difference. That would be a very worthwhile to look at. If not, I would look at ski socks that have double layers on them. You can purchase them, and Smart Wool is the name of another one, which is a wool on the outside with a polypro inside, and that can make a big difference too. And Tom right now is holding up his leg because he's got Smart Wool on his feet because he's double socks.
$20 for a pair of socks. I almost fell over, but I bought them anyway.
And how are they, Tom? Are they working
They're
well?
They're wonderful.
They're wonderful, you see?
I'm getting no money from the company.
No, that's
maybe
exact.
I'll get a box of socks, though.
How funny. Doctor, I had to also include that after I eat, I get especially cold as well.
It's part of that same issue. What happens after you eat is your blood supply goes to your gut. So it's going to your stomach, it's leaving your extremities, and it's doing the same thing. And some people actually who have this shiver after they eat. And I remember I had one patient who basically, as soon as he finished eating in a restaurant, I mean, he really had an extreme case, he had to put on a stocking cap and gloves in the restaurant because he felt so absolutely cold. And I happened to meet him at a conference. I was in Florida where it was really warm. And I said, I happened to meet him. I was at Disney World and I bumped into him. And I said, do you have to do it when you're here? And he took out his little knapsack and he said, here's my hat, here are my gloves. He said, whenever I eat, I have to do it. Doesn't matter what the temperature is. So it's really not a temperature thing in that case. It's a blood redistribution. The answer is yes. And like you say, you learn whether, you know, if you eat too much, there's too much blood that goes to your gut, and this is how you treat it.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
At least you've got some insight now. And once again, Tom is getting money when you buy Smart Wool socks. Don't listen to him at all.
That's not true.
He's got
that
stock in the company. The company is going gangbusters on the stock exchange.
I've got stock in nothing, which is lucky at this time. Speaking of temperatures, Zorba, time for another edition of your favorite segment, Stump the Doc. Our contestant today is Ashley from Jacksonville, Florida. Ashley writes, my husband and I are very similar in many ways, but we differ greatly in one big way. At night, as we're going to bed, I'm usually very cool to cold. My feet are like blocks of ice, and my overall core temp is relatively low. However, when I wake up in the morning, I heat up to the point of overheating and sweating and being extremely warm. My husband, on the other hand, goes to bed as warm as a cup of cocoa and wakes up in a state of relative chilliness. It's pretty much the exact opposite from me. Now, I'm not particularly concerned, as a bit of cuddling works for both situations, but I was wondering as to why this temperature change may be.
Well, I think it's a marriage problem. I think she married the wrong person. And that's clearly what it is. I think divorce is on the horizon. What you've got to do is marry somebody with the same temperature texture problems that you have, and then you can have problems, you know, the
Zorba
same.
Zorba is joking, of course.
Yes, no. But some people are just like that. Some people are hot when they go to sleep at night, and then during the night they cool off, and some people are cold and they have to bundle up when they go to sleep tonight. And then this is sort of the way it's our regulatory system. One of the things, by the way, that alters this system can be caffeine. Caffeine can change the circulatory system. And so basically, if you're drinking coffee or caffeinated products late in the day, eliminate that. Uh-huh. That may make a difference. But if not, it's just the way life is, and just live with it.
C'est la vie. Think you can stump our favorite family doc? Send us your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some really interesting research coming up, more of your calls, too, and our medical myth buster here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That phone number again, 1-800-462-7413. And you'll find a line open now if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, I find this fascinating, this study showing that somewhat overweight older people can improve their memory by just losing a few pounds?
Well, it's a fascinating study. First of all, we know what obesity is in the country. We know that half the country is basically overweight, more than half the country. It's a lot of people that are overweight. And then what do we get when we begin to lose weight? Well, we know that when we begin to lose weight and cut out calories, we reduce insulin resistance. We're less likely to get diabetes. If we have diabetes, mm-hmm. we'll get it in better control. And insulin resistance is a biggie. Now, they didn't look at insulin resistance here, although that might be part of the issue of why people are better, but they looked at memory and thinking skills among overweight adults. These are adults who were overweight but were not obese. They had a BMI above 25 but less than 30, mm-hmm. and they cut their calories by roughly 30%. And what they found was
How did they do this?
Well, they did it by a calorie restriction. So it was a simple calorie restriction diet, kind of similar to a Weight Watchers diet or an American
Dietary Association. But, I mean, how do they test their memories?
Well, they test their memory with a series of psychological tests like you would do in school, flash cards, looking at things, memory recall. It's a battery of tests that you would have, which would be similar to intelligence tests that none of us have taken for a gazillion years.
Yeah.
And they found that they were quicker at answering their questions, quicker at thinking skills, quicker at doing math skills, and so on. And it's fascinating. And the article was not published in some hack journal. It's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a major journal, a major publication.
So the ones that lost some weight,
the ones that went down to roughly 1,200 calories, that's a lot. I mean, that is a definite restriction of calories.
Their brains worked better.
Yeah. Now, why their brains work better, we don't know. There's a lot of theories about the fact that it may be because your insulin is working better. You don't have insulin resistance. You get sugar where you need it in the brain quickly when you want to have your brain work. It may be a reduction in C-reactive protein, this whole protein that is related to inflammation. There's no evidence of this at the time, but C-reactive protein is a biggie in terms of what it does. But nonetheless, their cognition was better. It may just be that the hippocampus and the prefrontal areas, which are parts of the brain that are associated with thinking, just work better in a situation such as this.
So we talk about heart-healthy diets, helping our hearts, helping the rest of our body, maybe. helping our brain, making us smarter.
Right, too. May actually make us smarter. It may be that when you're eating fewer calories, not only do you feel better, not only do you look better, not only is your blood sugar better, but it might be that you actually do better on your job or better at work. And that's another reason to look at it, especially this time of year when it's time to look at our calories and think about losing our weight. Now's the time to do it. Get less weight, get smart.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Sun Valley, Idaho. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm 57 years old and in good health, and I just got my first cholesterol numbers of 203, and I don't want to go on any medication, so I wonder, what am I doing wrong? What can I do right?
Well, 203 isn't necessarily bad. What is your HDL, the good cholesterol, and what is your LDL?
The HDL is 65.
Great. Fabulous number. You're better than, you're in the upper 5% of the population with that. And what's your LDL? What's your bad cholesterol?
122.
You're fine. You don't need to go on anything. Your numbers are perfect. They're great numbers.
In fact, you can start eating cheeseburgers.
That's exactly right. Cheeseburgers and oil, that's exactly it. But these are really, really, really great numbers. If you look at the national campaign to educate the population about cholesterol, if you look at the NSEP guidelines clearly look at risk factors. And any HDL above 40, certainly above 45, is considered to be fabulous. And 65 is a great number. And then our goal for our LDL is below 130 for you. Now, if you had diabetes, that would be different. Do you have diabetes?
I do not.
Okay. If you have diabetes, then the goal is to get the LDL or bad cholesterol below 100. And there's some people who theorize that diabetics, because heart attacks are a big issue in diabetics, should be on cholesterol medicines no matter what. And that's a different issue. But in a healthy person, your numbers are dynamite. They're really, really good numbers. Now, do you exercise?
5 days a week.
5 days a week. So, and you don't smoke cigarettes, obviously.
Correct.
And this cholesterol is fine. What's your doctor say? Did your doctor say you needed to be on something?
Well, my OBGYN did this blood test, and they were concerned.
There should be no concern at all. Exactly. These numbers are absolutely fine. There's some, and this is really an overread of the data. There's some people that say, well, we've really got to get this LDL down. We should push the medication. And there's no scientific basis for it. It's only for people who are at high risk. So what you want to do is you don't want to go on something like this. You are doing fine. Your family history, your mom or dad, there must be longevity on one side of your family or the other.
My 85-year-old father has had high cholesterol since his 40s.
Since his 40s. And he's a healthy guy now?
Yes.
He's a healthy guy now. Well, good luck.
Well, had double bypass.
Your numbers, well, I don't think you've got his genes. Not with an HDL or good cholesterol of 65 and an LDL of less than 130. You probably did not inherit his predisposition, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for the call at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, time now for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today. It comes to us from Kathy in Traverse City, Michigan. She'd like to know if there's any truth to the old claim that the best way to disinfect a sponge is to microwave it. It can't be that old a claim.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Old claim.
How
and I was thinking, what's old?
Claim?
It's microwaving. It's only been around for 3 or 4 years.
Well,
it hasn't been around that long.
More than 3 or 4 years, but
it's been around for several decades. The answer is there is truth to it.
Huh.
And there have been studies about this because, you know, sponges tend to be repositories of bacteria. And we use them because we put soap on them. But the fact is, those bacteria can live in those little crevices very, very easily. And when you microwave a sponge for 2 minutes in the microwave at high, you get rid of 99% of foodborne bacteria. 99%. So in other words, microwave your sponges. Of course, you don't want to cook the sponge. Some of the cheaper sponges might start to melt, but probably won't because you've got, you know, the sponges are always watery. But yeah, microwaving it for 2 minutes, dynamite, it really works. And in fact, In the first 15 seconds of microwaving, there's still lots of bacteria that are eliminating. So just throwing your sponges into the microwave for a minute or so is probably fine. As I said, at 2 minutes, you've got 99% reduction of bacteria.
That's really interesting. I never heard that.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do. It's probably periodically good to do around the house if you've got anyone who's ill or sick and you're worried about foodborne illness. It's probably a good idea if you sop up chicken juice, because we know that that has salmonella. Chicken juice and turkey juice, any poultry is likely to have salmonella. Just shove it in the microwave, put it on for 2 minutes, and then you know you're safe.
It should be wet when you put it in, or
doesn't
it doesn't
make a
matter?
Difference? Doesn't make a difference. No. You know, sponges are, once you put water in them, they stay moist, but it does not have to be wet.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Then send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Another listener on the phone now, Zorba, at 1-800-462-7413. This one from Edmond, Oklahoma. Hello.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How can we help you?
I've recently been diagnosed with seborrheic dermatitis on my face, and I'm just not real comfortable with the medications I've been prescribed. I'm wondering if there's any natural remedies, or if you have any advice on how I can, you know, maybe prevent these flare-ups or treat these while they're flaring up.
What are those medications that you're using?
Well, I've been given a kind of middle-of-the-road steroid, triamcinolone, and also a medication called Protopic.
Seborrheic dermatitis is really a common problem. When you have it in your scalp, it's dandruff. That's how it manifests. A bit about the creams, first of all. You have the Protopic for your face, but what about the triamcinolone? Where were you putting that?
That was going on my face as well.
Okay, so that's...
I read that, you know, if you used it too often, it could thin the skin. And then with the Protopic, I had read that there may be some increased risk for, you know, a secondary infection, or possibly, you know, there's been some reports of skin cancer, so...
Well, there are a few things that are going on. First of all, I wouldn't use triamcinolone on my face. It's not a good drug to use on a safe. It's too strong. It can produce thinning and something called telangiectasias, which are spider sort of marks that you don't want to have. They're unsightly. So you don't want to use it. It's too strong. The easiest thing to go to is a 2.5% hydrocortisone cream. You can only get it by prescription. And for many people, that's gentle enough to work. And the Protopic is also a very, very good drug. I don't think I'd be that concerned about the skin cancer issue, because I think it's sort of overblown, and I don't think the data really supports that. And that drug has been around, Protopic now has been around, I think about 6 or 7 years. It's often used on children, on young children, because it doesn't thin the skin and it appears to be much, much safer. So that drug is really pretty safe. Triamcinolone is not safe for the face. A couple of questions, though. We're talking about natural cures. When did this come on? When did it start to bother you?
Oh, it's been around for a couple of months now. And I've gone to two doctors. They both said seborrheic dermatitis, but I have been diagnosed with eczema. You know, that was when I was a child, but it hasn't flared up in, you know, a decade or so.
Uh-huh. And these are kind of related together. You can really have both, or sometimes they're hard to differentiate between one or the other. Did one doctor give you the triamcinolone and the other one give you the Protopic?
Yes. My primary care gave me the triamcinolone.
Uh-huh. And the dermatologist gave you the Protopic.
Yes,
right, right. Exactly. Triamcinolone should not be used on the face. That's what you don't want to have. Now, from a food point of view, the answer is individual differences. Some people find when they eat hot and spicy foods tends to make it worse. Some do not. Do you wash your face with soap? What sort of soap do you use when you wash your face?
Well, I've been using this Cetaphil.
Cetaphil is great. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Yes, Cetaphil is just the type of soap that you want to use on your face. So you're kind of doing everything right. What I would recommend doing is get it under control with the Protopic. I think it's safe. I really do. If that doesn't work, call your family doc or the dermatologist for 2.5% hydrocortisone cream. And then once it gets under control in the face, see how often you have to use the Protopic. It may only be once a week. It might be twice a week. It might be once a month. It might only be with flares. But you've got to really be intensive with it initially to get it under control, and then quite often you can kind of taper off a bit. But I do think it's safe. I want to give you that assurance.
Well, great. Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. We appreciate the call. I don't say this often enough. You're really smart. You're a good doctor. You're a good doctor. You are. I mean, people ask me, does he know what these questions are before they come? And the answer is no.
Yeah, no, I don't know.
You don't ever hear about or see these questions, and they come out, and you are just
a
smart guy.
Well, that's very, thank you.
Before we get out of here for the week, or before Zorba's head gets too big, we have another case for Judge Zorba. This case comes out of Appleton, Wisconsin, and finds Tracy as the prosecutor and Tracy's boyfriend as the defendant. And it looks like there are multiple indictments in this one. Seems Tracy's boyfriend has given up smoking, but not chewing tobacco. Tracy says that this proves that he has not kicked his addiction to nicotine. Her boyfriend rebukes that statement and adds that chewing tobacco is more addictive than heroin. How do you find on both counts of his argument?
Well, first of all, chewing tobacco is not more addictive than heroin. Cigarette smoking may be more addictive than heroin. I mean, because very few people chew compared to the number of people who smoke.
Isn't chewing more addictive than smoking?
Not at all. People become addicted to tobacco. They become addicted to the nicotine that goes into their body, and it's the same addiction. There's no study that shows one is more addictive, and it's not as if heroin is the ultimate addiction. Frankly, heroin is not as addictive as tobacco. We don't have as many people who use heroin as use tobacco.
Well, no, I know, but once you're on it, it could be more addictive or less addictive.
You know, the number of people don't. I do not. There's no evidence that chewing tobacco is more addictive than smoking. Smoking is highly addictive. Chewing tobacco is highly addictive. Snuff is highly addictive. They're all comparable.
Tracy is certainly right. He has not kicked his nicotine
100%
habit.
He has not kicked his nicotine habit. Now, if he wants to kick the nicotine habit, go to the nicotine gum. Nicorette gum is great, and in fact, it's safer, it doesn't cause cancer, and 5% of the people who start the gum can't give it up.
Yeah, but guess what? At least from the information I have from this email, he doesn't want to give
it up. No, he doesn't want to give it up. It's pretty obvious that he's going to keep on chewing and keep on spitting.
If you have a health or lifestyle debate smoldering without an answer and need one, send your case to Judge Zorba at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week.
Take care, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, with help from interns Ann Tenna and Mike Raffone. Charles Monroe Kane, that's a real name, oversees the whole shebang. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0207Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.